Sets for the horror-thon, and remember the big giveaway at 9. Don't miss it, and don't forget to wear your masks. The clock is ticking. It's almost time.
Silver Shamrock my ass.
You're gonna need a bigger pouch.
Welcome to the Graveyard Shit Podcast.
You're gonna die in there! All of you! You are gonna die!
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Graveyard Shit Podcast. We have got something good for you today. Yeah, there it is. Bride of the Animator. What can you say about this movie? It's like, you know, some bright spark said, you know what? Reanimator wasn't over the top enough. Let's do it. And they might have been crazy, but I tell you what, they're crazy brilliant. Because very rarely do you get a movie that, you know, works as well as the original, and you get that here. So, you know.
Well, you want a quick synopsis real quick?
Yep, go for it.
Just read just a piece. I won't read the whole thing. On the back of the Arrow release, it has been 8 months since the bloody massacre at Miskatonic Medical School. Unperturbed by the disastrous outcome of his previous meddling with the dead, Dr. West, again played by Jeffrey Combs, thank God for that, continues his research into the phenomenon of reanimation, only this time he plans to create life, starting with the heart of his young protege, Dan's dearly deceased, Meg Halsey, of course, Barbara Crampton.
Yep.
Surely nothing could go wrong. Not when you have a freaking smorgasbord of a special effects feast as you do here with all the freaking multiple K&B Screaming Mad George freaking Wayne Toth on working with Beekler's John Carl Beekler's company, who would go on to, of course, direct Friday 7. And I don't know if there's any movie that has that many pieces of a special effects crew like this, and they all had different aspects of what they brought to the film, but that is remarkable. I mean, just having K&B in its totality is remarkable.
Yeah, definitely.
And in 90, all three were still part of K&B. So, you know, you got, you know, Kurtzman, Berger, Nicotero, you know, and all they bring. And then, of course, I always forget about Wayne Toth. I had totally forgot. But I was when I was rewatching this the other night, I was letting the credits roll, and all of a sudden I saw Wayne Toth's name pop. I'm like, what? He worked underneath in the magical media industry, I think, which was Beekler's company. Wayne Toth, and Wayne Toth, man. I mean, of course, if you don't know, Rob Zombie's right hand man, you know, and all his, you know, House of a Thousand Corpses, right up through Lords of Salem, and. But Wayne Toth goes way back. I mean, I'm pretty sure he even worked on Return of the Jedi.
I think so.
Yeah, I mean, he was part of a lot. His filmography is huge, but near and dear to my heart, just because of, you know, Rob Zombie leaned on him hard.
Wayne Toth is one of the reasons why, you know, like the early 90s, like to early 2000s, like Full Moon stuff was so fun. You know, he did a lot of the stuff on, like, I think he worked on, like, the Subspecies movies, Puppet Master movies, stuff like that, you know. Stuff that you wouldn't think, but when you actually think about it, the effects are pretty decent.
You know? The effects are pretty freaking outstanding.
So they're kind of...
The only goofy thing is the whole finger eyeball thing. I mean, But even that works. I mean, you gotta love it. There's almost seemingly a nod to, well, this is what this is. Yeah, 90. So this is, there's all a callback to instead of a Farewell to Arms book lying on top of the hand and Evil Dead 2. It's the anatomical book being dropped on that little finger thing, squashing it like a fly or something. Or yeah, and then that is comical. There is some, I mean, and you know, yeah, some of the lines may be a little, but I mean, when Jeffrey Combs delivers that line, you know, how dare you judge my work? I mean, there is a level of, like, he means it.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Who are you to judge what I have done? And he really does bring it to life. I mean,
yeah. Well, let's be honest. Like, if you just let Jeffrey Combs chew the scenery, you're going to get a good movie.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what it is, he's going to bring something to it. But honestly, he has Herbert West down.
Yes.
It was like the other day I was watching a video popped up about I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. And I forgot that Jeffrey Combs had a cameo in that. And I was thinking to myself, like, God, you have Jeffrey Combs in your movie and you do nothing with him. That is such a waste. Like, could you imagine how much more infinitely entertaining I Still Know What You Did Last Summer would have been if they had just let Jeffrey Combs do his thing and, you know, try to set him up as maybe like a red herring for the killer and stuff like that. It's like, think of how much more entertaining that movie would have been.
You know? What's the guy say? Nice dog. Not really.
Done in there, they should just taken out the white Jamaican guy and replaced him with Jeffrey Combs.
Yeah, to me, anytime you could take Jack Black out of a movie, I'm fine with it.
Yeah. You know, take him out, just take the dreadlocks, put them on Jeffrey Combs.
Pay to see that. Well, I mean, there you go. I mean, Jeffrey Combs, I mean, he had quite a, I mean, run. You know, the one thing that he shared with Stuart Gordon is their time in theater on the stage. And it is quite amazing for Stuart Gordon to literally step off the stage of directing plays. I think in Chicago he was where, and then he got, you know, a chance, you know, to bring Lovecraft to life, but really he brought what he did on the stage right onto, you know, in a theatrical presentation, you know, I mean, his over the topness, the things he did. And Jeffrey Combs came out of the, you know, off stage too. And there's a real, with Stuart Gordon's film, but I mean, Usna was producer on that film. And so, I mean, we talked about that last show about the special effects artist who steps in, you know, for the sequel. Here is the producer stepping in, but one who has an inherent love of, you know, horror cinema and just Lovecraft and everything. And although some of that came late, I think, in his life, maybe not horror per se, but Lovecraft came a little bit later for him. But I mean, really think about it. Like, if you were to like step back before, just as say Fango or Gorza, whoever first announced, you know, hey, Yuzna's going to step into the director's chair and direct the sequel to Rand. How many of us would have went, what?
Yeah.
And look what he did.
Yeah.
In some ways, this is my Reanimator movie. As great and over the top as the first one is, this is, I love this freaking movie, man. I love freaking Dr. Hill with the whole Batwing and his head, you know, flying just... the Peruvian Civil War, the opening battle sequence, you know, and just you know, and then just I think this they tapped into and I want to pull that up here a little bit, but they tapped into specifically two of the six sections of the Lovecraft story Reanimator. It's six sections in that story, and I went back this week and I actually reread that a few times, and because it's been a while since I read it, and
nice.
So what's your, so like, Lonnie, start with you. What's your history with this movie or just with Reanimator in general?
Okay. Before I start, I just want to take a minute to say, Okay, all you horror fans out there, today is Valentine's Day. This is what we do. We talk about stuff like Bride of Reanimator. That's our idea of Valentine's Day movies.
And this is a perfect Valentine's Day movie, man. I mean,
so happy Valentine's Day, everybody. So,
you don't get any better than with her ripping her own heart out and going,
"Yeah,
what you want?
You know, how more do you show you love somebody when you pull out your own heart? What do you want? You know." So yeah, this is what us horror fans do on Valentine's Day. We talk about Bride of Reanimator. Okay, the first time that I remember being young and I had gotten sick, and I know that I had to go to the doctor. We stopped at a video store on the way home, and they told me to keep me home for a couple of days. So I was at home. I was laying on the couch. My mom decided to rent some movies for us to watch, and Reanimator had just come out. And, you know, like, we went to the video store. They had a copy of it there, and you know, they had the poster and all that kind of stuff, and we just decided, like, what the heck, you know, let's check it out, see what it's all about. And then, you know, put it on, and I watched it, and I was just sucked into it. I was just like, this movie is awesome. Like, the effects are amazing. You know, like Jeffrey Combs is Herbert West. I mean, he just sucks you in. Like, anytime he's on screen, you are laser focused on him. You want to see everything he does. You want to see everything he says. Of course, Barbara, you know, being a young boy getting into, you know, puberty and stuff, Barbara Crampton really was not a bad way to start. You know, the only thing is, I was like, it was like that old meme, you know, where it's like, you know, when you're watching the movie by yourself, all this other stuff coming on is happening. But it's like, of course, when it gets to the head gives head scene, that's when my mother happens to walk into the room, and she's like, what the fuck is this? You know, oh my God. Yes, you know, she's like, because she wasn't watching the movie, she was doing other stuff. Is the rest of the movie like this? No, this is the first time this anything like this is in there. And she's all like, okay, turn away and look. It's like, well, Mom, it's already over now, and all that stuff. And she's like, do you know what he was doing? It's like, I have a good idea, Mom. She's like, oh my God, the things I let my kids watch. But anyway, it's like, you know, but no, I just, I watched the movie and I loved it. And I was really genuinely sad because I thought at the end of the movie that Herbert West died. And it was like, I want to see more of this character. Yeah. So, you know, and then years later, when we got the word that, you know, it came out in Fangoria and stuff that, you know, we're going to get a sequel, Bride of Reanimator. I was like, okay, well, all right. Okay, Brian Usna is directing instead of Jeffrey Combs or Stuart Gordon. Okay, Jeffrey Combs is coming back. I'm sold. That's all you need to give me. Jeffrey Combs is coming back. I was like, you know, Bruce Abbott is coming back to play Dan. Okay, I like Bruce Abbott and stuff. All right, so okay, I'm down for this and everything. And then it came on late night cable. That was the first time I saw Bride of Reanimator. And I didn't think that I could be any more blown away than I was when I watched the first movie. The thing that just, you know, the 80s was such a great time to watch horror movies because there was so much imagination going into all these movies. And it was just great to see, like, all these special effects artists just really putting their minds to work. I mean, you know, you got like Rob Bottin and The Thing and, you know, all the stuff that Tom Savini was doing. You know, we were seeing what Rick Baker could do with American Werewolf in London and all this kind of stuff. And it was just like to watch like all these special effects creators, you know, like what you were saying, you know, like Wayne Toth, Screaming Mad George, K&B, and on, and to see them all, you know, you're sitting there like, did they come to Brian Usna and say, hey, we have an idea for this, that, or the other thing? Or did Brian Usna just gather all these people around and say, do what you want, go nuts, surprise me, let's do whatever we can do? It's like, either way, it doesn't matter because, and then just to see all the stuff that they did in that movie with the special, like, you know, talking about like the little finger thing with the eyeball and all that stuff. And, you know, the one thing I thought was funny, I'll get to that in a minute, but like when Herbert West, like he's bored, and he's got the leg on the table. So I was like, okay, so I'll take the arm and I'll connect the arm to the leg, put the fluid on it, and then it's like he's fighting with it and all that kind of stuff and everything else. And it's like, oh, man, just like I said, just the imagination of it all, But I think the one thing that just kind of always made me laugh was like, I mean, I get, you know, I get the idea that Herbert West is supposed to be like this mad scientist. He's supposed to be a bit crazy. But you're sitting there kind of like, did Herbert West ever stop to think like, okay, here's the thing. Every time I use my reanimation fluid on something or somebody, it's like I always get the same result. They always come back. They're always out of control. And, you know, 10 times out of 10, I always wind up having to destroy it or it destroys itself. You know, it's like maybe I should take some time to see if I could maybe like do something with the formula and stuff so that maybe this doesn't happen. But it's like that's kind of the funny part is that Herbert West, like he just keeps doing the same thing over and over and over again. He keeps expecting a different reaction and it never happens. You know, even going into the third movie, it's like he just keeps doing it over and over again. And I just think that's funny. It's like obviously he's crazy, but oh man. And just, you know, yeah, I love that one. And then, you know, then even when I watched Beyond Reanimator, that one was a lot of fun too. You know, especially like, the one part that always cracks me up is the drug addict who's like, he can't get enough drugs into his system. So he gets a hold of the reanimation fluid, you know, and he ends up turning himself inside out. And Herbert West comes, he sees the formula and he looks in there. The guy's turned himself inside. He's like, hey man, give me some more of that shit. And Herbert West's like, I think you've had enough. And he's like, don't you hold out on me, motherfucker. But just, I just always remember, just, I immediately fell in love with Reanimator and then Bride of Reanimator. Cause like, it was just so amazing. Like the '80s was such a great time for horror and science fiction movies, just because like everybody was like always, you know, especially with special effects, like how much more can we do? How much further can we push it? They did this in this movie. Let's see if we could take it a step farther and all that kind of stuff. And that's amazing. You know, I wish we could get more movies like that nowadays where you could get, you know, you get a director, even if they don't have the biggest budget in the world, it's like, I'm going to get like, you know, special effects artists and we're going to kind of go old school and say, you know what, this is what the subject of the movie is. Surprise me. Use your imaginations. Try to come up with something innovative. You know, let's maybe see, you know, maybe everything's already been done, but let's see, maybe we could kind of come up with something new or at the very least put a new spin on something. You know, I wish we could get more stuff like that. The one thing I thought was funny, though, too, is the Italian girl in Bride of Reanimator. I don't know if you guys ever saw the movie Sunday School.
It's Summer like, School.
Summer School. Yeah, Summer School.
Anne Marie.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's funny that you have the girl from Summer School who is basically being drooled over by the two horror movie geeks and everything. Then you turn around, you put her in a real horror movie and all that kind of stuff. I thought that was kind of fun too, you know. But so that's it for me. But just, seeing on TV and seeing on video and just always loved it. And I had to make sure I had these. So.
What about you, Glenn?
For me, well, obviously it started with the first Reanimator. And the thing is, this is kind of weird, because when I first saw Reanimator, I didn't like it. You know, maybe I think probably at the time I'd rented it probably expecting something else. Like, I think I expected it, like, a more serious horror movie. And, you know, kind of the comedy and elements of it were kind of bothered me at the time. But, you know, so that was the first time I saw it, obviously. Then, you know, a bit later, I rented it again. And I was like, you know, I'm going to give this another shot. You know, so I keep hearing about this. I'm going to watch it again. Second time, I loved it. Absolutely loved it. And it's just, what can you say about a movie that ends with like a guy being pulled away by the intestines of an undead creature? You know, it was just so awesome. Then I heard about Bride. Bride actually, it came out on VHS and I had no real interest in it. I don't know why, but I just didn't have an interest. And then I saw a certain issue of Fangoria. And it was the one that had the bride there and have a showed like all her neck like flayed and everything. And like it was just such like a striking. I was like, you know what? I'm gonna rent this. So I rented it and I thoroughly enjoyed it. It's gonna sound really funny to say it this way, but I find Bride has more heart than the first Reanimator. You know, and it kind of really does, literally. But you know, my only gripe with it at the time was, you know, they didn't have what's her name? Barbara Crampton. But yeah. She was back. Like I was hoping that, you know, it was gonna be like that she was gonna get resurrected and like then like Herbert West was gonna make his own bride and that was kind of the thing. That's what I was hoping at the time. But I thoroughly enjoyed it. You know, and to this day, one of my favorite lines ever put on celluloid. Take a note, Dan. Tissue rejection. I that line gets me every time. It's like all this horror is happening, and he's just like, take a note. Tissue rejection. And the thing is, you know full well that Herbert West is thinking, oh, okay. Well, next time I'll have to do this. And also, I gotta say, the finger eyeball thing, it was cute. Yeah. You know, it was cute.
You know, it almost kind of reminded me a little bit of the stop motion stuff that was used in that you always forget about, but was in the original Piranha when you got to see those little creatures. Yeah, it reminded me of that a little bit.
Yeah, I loved that little thing. And then I just love the fact also that Herbert West is making these like creatures, and then, you know, he's like, well, it's too much work to get rid of them. I'll just chuck them in this hole, which is in a crypt next door. It's like just throwing them in there. It's like,
which, if you remember, we get the little nod to Rats in the Walls.
Oh, yeah.
Which is a nice little nod to another story from H.P. Lovecraft.
Oh, yeah.
Honestly, I can't help it. One thing I can't help, it makes me laugh. It's like after, you know, he reanimates the inspector and the inspector kills the girl's dog. And all this stuff, and Herbert, you know, Dr. West, he's looking at it, he's all like, wrap the arm of a person onto a dog. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
And then she comes down, she sees the dog and everything, and then the dog tries shaking her. It's just like, is that the, you know, it's like, it's so crazy, but it's so much fun to watch. It's just, Herbert West is just like, oh shit, I'll reanimate anything. Doesn't matter what it is anymore. It's like, you know.
The thing is, he has no internal, like, you know how most people have that thing in their brain where they're going to say something and then they think, you know what, I probably shouldn't say that. He has that, but he doesn't have that for doing things. You know, it's like here's an arm, here's a leg. Oh, I could stitch those together. Let's do it. You know, yeah. As opposed to like most normal people be like, oh, look, there's an arm, there's a leg. I better throw those out. No, he's like, I could stitch those together. You know, I could take these two people, like, cut them in half length ways and stick them the wrong way together. It's like, he has no impulse control. There we go. Herbert West, ADHD.
Yeah.
But I love
it. As much as I love the acting, you know, the acting is so much fun to watch. I told you guys this right before we started recording, but like, I just love that some of the acting is so hammy in this movie. It's so over the top, but it's fun to watch. Like, the, you know, I was telling you guys about the inspector coming in and, you know, I was like, do you believe that dead? Is dead Dr. West? He's like, you butcher and all this stuff. And, you know, he's like, yo, your wife died of multiple contusions. She fell. Ha! She fell, did she? It's like, it's so hammy, but at the same time, it's just
it's hammy, watch. But underneath the surface, that is kind of a scary thought to think that this guy actually might have beat his wife to death.
Yeah.
And he is being basically accused of killing his own wife when he is trying to throw the blame on someone else. And it was kind of – because it kind of flies in the face of who this guy seems to be, you know, in terms of how we're getting to know this guy. But, you know, what is it Herbert says to Dan, you know, he's the wife beater, get the gun.
Yeah. Oh,
but you know, I was listening to an interview with Jeffrey Combs. I think it was on I don't know why this stuff always happens to me.
Happens every time.
Yeah. There's three sources. If you want to dig deeper with Jeffrey Combs or John or Stuart Gordon, you've got Mick Garris's archive and his postmortem that you can find on Spotify or YouTube probably. You can you got the Movie Crypt that's hosted in part by Adam Green. They interviewed Jeffrey Combs. And then you've got Eli Ross' History of Horror on Spotify, the audio versions of those or expanded interviews. And Jeffrey Combs, I don't know if Jeffrey Combs is in there. Stuart Gordon is. For sure. But you listen like to Jeffrey Combs, and I think he mentioned at one point where call it hamminess or whatever. But I'm pretty sure he said there were points where him and Bruce sort of got together and were like, you know, we know this is supposed to be a really serious film at heart, but we got to remind the audience that we're sort of here with them. And, you know, and so we're all dealing with the same thing. And so, you know, kind of lighten a little bit, you know, just kind of make a little more fun in light of it, you know, and probably, I mean, I think both Stuart and Usna both are trying in spite of the hamminess or the over the topness, they're both trying to create a pretty serious view of Lovecraft.
Mm-hmm.
Which for my own part, and I guess I'm sort of a kind of a well, pun intended, I guess, a stitch, you know, like both of you in a way. I think I remember renting Reanimator on VHS. So I would have been 15 when, or probably 16 when it showed up in the video store. And yeah, I think I was a huge fan of Evil Dead 2. Loved Evil Dead 2. And I love that sort of comedy. I love that sort of over the topness. But there was something about Reanimator that I think, like you, Glenn, I just at first I wasn't sure. I got captivated by like some of the stills in Fangoria where the intestine where it was, you know, had flowed out and all in that moment at the end. But I think I kind of walked away. I think I remember not being that high for whatever reason on it at the time as well. And unfortunately I would have missed Bride because that came out in 90 and I was just going into the Army in 90. So there was a stretch about almost six years really before. And that's not to say I completely shut myself off of horror, but because of the Army, the inability of me to really be in as I was as a kid.
Mm.
I wasn't, I mean, I was still grabbing my Fangos if I could. I was, you know, I was still trying, but more of an outsider, I guess. Trying to keep up a little bit of what was happening, even in those first few years of the early 90s. And then eventually, you know, I started to come back into horror really strong. But Reanimator was something that I didn't revisit. But eventually I fell into Lovecraft. And I started just consuming, you know, his stories. And then somewhere, probably because of Body Bags, I would imagine, somewhere along the way, Reanimator popped up. And immediately, because of my love of Lovecraft and source material, immediately I was sort of like, I don't know. That's not really Reanimator. That's something else. That's not Reanimator. That's not the Lovecraft story. That's, you know, it's World War One. It's a more of a period piece, and it's more, you know, and then I don't know. I saw on Amazon one day, about the same time as I was picking up the Anchor Bay, Day of the Dead, I picked up, Reanimator. I figured, you know, I just pick it up and check it out. And I started to see it in a different way. I started to see it more. And I think what helped actually was what I was a fan of in the 80s was or had rented it on VHS was Dagon. I was a huge fan of Dagon, but I wasn't understanding the implications of, well, what is this? This is, you know, Shadow over Innsmouth, and this is Dagon, and it's sort of, you know, these two stories compressed into a film by, you know, Stuart Gordon. I mean, I didn't understand all that other stuff. I rented it and I saw it and I'm like, dang, this was a creepy movie. This is freaking weird. And, you know, and so, I mean, I was a huge fan of that. And then knowing Stuart Gordon eventually, you know, right. You know, I had to revisit Reanimator. And then, so I slowly started to come around a little bit. And then one day, well, last year and a half or whatever, I was in one of my places and, you know, and I saw Bride. And, you know, you don't see arrows pop up all the time in there. And I don't know, I think he was selling this for, $29.98, $30. But, you know, I popped it open. I looked at the two discs, the book, everything's in there. I'm going to go and get it. And I rushed home and I actually watched it that night. And I fell in love with this movie. I mean, this movie absolutely just blew my mind away. Just the aesthetics of it. I think that a lot of dark colors in this. I wonder what this would look like on 4K. If they had a good negative to work with. But Bride, I mean, immediately I was like, okay, I see Lovecraft in here more than I remember ever seeing it in the first film. There is definitely, this is my love. This is my Reanimator right here. But then that led me into a much more serious revisiting of Reanimator, the first film. And now at this point, I think I've come to fully accept Stuart's, you know, initial vision and using us, especially his continuation. Now I still haven't seen, and if I have, I completely forgot. I don't have any recollection of actually seeing Beyond, so I don't know what that's like in comparison to, you know, these two films. But so I don't know. I've come around a lot on these, and this has taken me. And it kind of goes back a little bit, Lonnie, I think, to why I have a hard time with the the thing that sort of spoofs the movies that you're always talking about.
Riff tracks.
Yeah, the riff tracks. I'm too seriously wired for my own good. And, you know, so I mean, I appreciated your one video that you did recently, you know, when you were talking about that. And I actually, when I got home, having listened to that, I immediately went and double checked my Devilfish, and I don't have the riff tracks on there, for whatever reason. It's kind of, cause I was going to try to revisit that. But so I don't know. Lovecraft, I still love the written word. I love the source material. I love the story. And there's a lot in there that has not been tapped into. I mean, we could easily, even if someone just wanted to sort of revisit from a fresh perspective on new Reanimator, you know, film, but maybe leap off of another section of one of the sections. Because this was what? This came out, this was written in 1922 in six segments for Homebrew. So it wasn't even anything big like Weird Tales or anything. It was this other publication, and it was a publication just to make him some money real quick. And if I remember, Lovecraft wasn't even that high on his own story, on this own story. Which is amazing, because it makes you wonder what he would think if he could sit in a theater and watch.
Yeah.
Reanimator. You know, I wonder if it would give him a real chuckle. I wonder if he would, you know, see some of the things in there from his own story that maybe even we're missing, you know.
Maybe.
No matter how many times we, you know, we reread or read, you know, the stories or whatever. But I don't know. But I did come across something. I think it might interest you guys a little bit. In the section in Reanimator, there's a short little where is it? Right here. There's a short little piece. Okay. So it comes from the Horror from the Shadows, which is the segment from World War One.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last section, which the Tomb Legions, which a lot of it is the connected with the cemetery and all that crazy stuff that ends up happening in the end. But there's this one paragraph, and I thought this is seriously, this is freaking Herbert West, man. There's this paragraph, and it sort of goes, of his methods in the intervening 5 years, I dare not speak. Of course, you know, we know Bruce Abbott is the narrator, and he's more closely tied. I mean, he is his assistant in the original story.
Mm.
And the thing that keeps him disconnected from West in the movies is his failed relationships with women. Because they always end up failing somehow, some way. But he says, Lovecraft says, I was held, this is the narrator, or Bruce Abbott, if you want. I was held to him by sheer force of fear and witnessed sights that no human tongue could repeat. Gradually, I came to find Herbert West himself more horrible than anything he did. That was when it dawned on me that that his once normal scientific zeal for prolonging life has subtly degenerated into a mere morbid and ghoulish curiosity and a secret sense of carnal picturesqueness. His interest became a hellish and perverse addiction to the repellently and fiendishly abnormal. He gloated calmly over artificial monstrosities which would make most healthy men drop dead from fright and disgust. He became, behind his pallid intellectuality, a fastidious Baudelaire, that's how you say his name, right, of a physical experiment, a languid Elagabalus of the tombs. Now, interesting, when you looked up this guy, I didn't realize it was a guy's name, Baudelaire. He was a French poet. But his name carries a little meaning to it, and it is a, if you take it in its meaning, what it ends up being is a spiritless god of the mountain of the tombs.
Hmm.
This guy Baudelaire, as a French poet, one of his main nemesis, who was always on the attack on him in his work, said, and think if this isn't Herbert West, everything, this French poet's work, everything in it which is not hideous is incomprehensible. Everything one understands is putrid.
Hmm?
That's Herbert West.
It really is, yeah.
And you know, this word Elagabalus is just a how word did I without life, an absolute without. I think is what or spiritless, without life, spiritless. And so I did a little bit more reading on this French poet. This guy is from the mid-1500s, and he was a contemporary or pretty close there with Edgar Allan Poe.
Oh.
Which makes sense because Lovecraft, you know, he looked up to Poe. Poe was his, you know, his main guy. And he, I'm sure Lovecraft would have been, well, he had to have been well aware of this poet because he uses his name in order to add depth to Herbert West's character. And so I pulled off, I found one short poem that this guy wrote from circa, right, you know, around 1857. And this guy was not liked. This guy was not liked at all. And it, and partly, well, this is the kind of stuff he wrote. There's a poem he wrote called Magnetic Whore. And now remember, this is mid-1800s. Beneath the sky so livid and strange, tormented like thy destiny, what thoughts within thy spirit range themselves, O libertine, reply. With vain desires forever torn towards the uncertain in the vast, and yes, like Ovid, I'll not mourn, who from his Roman heaven was cast. O heavens, turbulent as the streams, in you I mirror forth my pride. Your clouds, which clad in mourning glide, and I love this ending, are the hearses of my dreams, and in your illusion lies the hell wherein my heart delights to dwell. If that's not Herbert West,
yeah,
I this guy is, and it's funny because he's, you have to dig for it, but when you do, you find this mad scientist creature is I mean, he is a god of the mountain of tombs. And in a way, Jeffrey Combs brings that to life.
Yeah. He does.
In his own way. He is not to be messed with. I mean, even in the Peruvian scene, two points that are interesting in that, you know, in terms of the source material. One, he doesn't have any problem just shooting people.
Yeah.
And second, you know, it does mention somewhere in that section, it does mention that even in the midst of all of the horror that, you know, because he loved just the idea of just having an endless number of dead bodies and body parts and everything else that he could get his hands on. He does, it's mentioned by the narrator that he does do good with the soldiers, though. He does save soldiers. Maybe out of convenience or just to keep his, you know, his position intact, you know, keep people away from him or out, you know. But he, when that scene, when he looks down at Bruce Abbott and he's like, you're going to be all right, buddy. I mean, there's a genuine quality. Now, maybe it's just, you know, the need to have him along as an assistant as much as he can, because you can't find any, you know, you can't find an assistant like that anywhere.
No, you can't. No.
And so it is interesting how, you know, the bride ends up being, you know, the mechanism that really does draw these two together. And there's that incredible scene when she, being brought to life, is embracing Bruce Abbott, and she won't accept. Talk about tissue rejection. She rejects her maker because the heart that beats inside of her is Meg's.
Mm-hmm.
But even what was her character's name? Gloria, the girl in the hospital bed. Mm-hmm. She also has an affection for him.
Yep.
And both Meg and her really, they are conflicted. And so it's almost like in the end, it's not even so much his, what's her name in there, Francesca. It's not even, I don't know if it's her own, if it's her jealousy over Francesca as much as Gloria's jealousy over Meg.
Yeah.
You know, when he says, I don't want your body. And that's when we get that great moment, you know, when she just lunges or pulls her heart on and like, is this what you want? Meaning, is Meg what you want? Is that who you want? You don't want me? And so it's almost kind of like Francesca is sort of an outsider. She's almost like an outsider to this, even though the two go at it. And, you know, you get that wonderful scene where, you know, West is like, my girl is superior to your girl. Your girl doesn't stand a chance. That whole scene as it unfolds is so great. It's just, and there's so much going on than what may appear to be going on. That it is like, I think you said, I think it was Glenn, you said, it's where the heart comes from.
Yeah.
Pun intended, really. I mean, there's a lot of heart in this. There's a lot going on, a lot being thought about. And it's not, you know, and the whole character of Gloria is, and Bruce Abbott's relationship, Dan's relationship to her. He so desperately wants to save her, wants to see her, you know, resurrected in the right way, that he wants to heal her, right?
Yep.
Restore her life. And maybe there's a relationship with her, you know, if he can, you know, somehow, you know, and there's so much. I mean, and you know, just we mentioned that the cop who, you know, the Arkham police guy who's, you know, whose wife is in the sanitarium all messed up. And I don't remember, is she like, do we know of her in the first movie? Is it like, because she's talked about as she's part of the Miskatonic massacre in the sense that somehow she gets the serum and she's brought back to life. But is she in the movie? Is she,
like, I don't recall anything about her from the first movie or anything.
Yeah.
Nothing rings a bell. No.
Because I'm trying to remember that whole scene that takes place of how many people are actually involved in that. I know there's a lot of chaos and a lot of crazy, crazy stuff going on in the end. And
unless maybe, like, you know, because, you know, in the first movie, you know, Dr. Hill goes into the morgue and he starts injecting all the different bodies with it. Maybe she was one of the bodies. That's about the only thing I could maybe think of.
Yeah.
Because we don't see, you know, like an older woman get killed or anything like that or any of that kind of stuff. That would be the only thing I could think of. It's just when Hill, you know, resurrected all those dead bodies, maybe she was one of them. That's about the best thing I could think of.
Yeah. That is interesting. It's almost kind of like, in a way, Exorcist 3, how you kind of get these characters who are now in the absolute forefront of things but are mentioned in the first film, who are in the background of things, are now brought forth, you know. And you know, what Dr. Graves' character, what a loon he is, man.
Yeah.
he's like that guy, he's like that I want to be West, but I'll never be like West because I just don't have the smarts for it or something.
Yeah. He resurrects Dr. Hill's head. You would think, like, the minute he resurrects Dr. Hill's head, as soon as Hill insults him, be like, okay, fuck this guy. I'm putting him back down again.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, dude, I'm not going to sit here and let this, you know, goddamn head sit here and call me all these names and try to boss me around. Fuck him. Okay, you know what? Maybe you were dead for a reason, prick. I'm putting you back down, you know. You would think.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, well, I love how he just wraps up his head and throws it in the trash.
Yeah.
And he's generally a little bit terrified when he shows back there. Of course, he's got the Arkham cop as his stooge now. And that is kind of weird. That scene is weird. Okay, so I rewatched this the other night with my wife. This movie runs, what, an hour and 36. I don't know if I've ever in an hour and 36 heard this phrase as much as I've heard then. And it was, oh, that is so wrong. Oh, that is so wrong. And I'm thinking to myself, and I never said it, but I'm thinking to myself, oh, I am so glad we're not watching the first movie. So glad we're not watching, especially for that one scene. I'm so glad we're not watching the first one. But that was absolutely, but I think by the end of it, she even sort of, she was sensing that there was other things deeper going on that made it an intriguing, intriguing film. And you got to love it though, how he's, you know, just how everything in the end sort of kind of springs on him. And it almost sort of reminds you the climax in a way, kind of weird way, climax of Maniac.
Yeah.
How, you know, all his phantoms come form in the end. And to him though, they're real. They're alive. They're breathing. But for us, they're sort of almost Lovecraftian phantoms that are just, you know, come in form to take him away. Yeah. There's, yeah, so I don't know. What else? I mean, there's actually a lot of stuff in this thing.
There is. It's a much, how can I put it? It's a much deeper movie than you think. You know, your first thought is automatically like, okay, Bride of Reanimator. It's like Bride of Frankenstein. And it does have that element to it, but there's a lot more in there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I got this book, Lovecraft in Transition. It's a collected works essays from Joshi, ST Joshi. Which, mm-hmm. You guys have the Vestron release of Dagon?
No, I never. No.
He's got a, I think it's the only Lovecraft film that he's got an interview on, mm-hmm. which is pretty decent, although it's kind of for Dagon, but he does speak a little bit to the other. There's an interesting little thing in here in this essay he wrote called on Reality and Knowledge. From Lovecraft's perspective and where he kind of stood on these things. But in terms of pride, he talks about this ancient Greek idea of hubris, and overweening pride was a strong one in Lovecraft. But while the Greeks applied it to a man's belief that he was the equal or superior of the gods, who would then castigate him for such notion, Lovecraft seemed to apply it to a human being's notion that he could subvert or control natural law. And who in many cases came very close to doing it. Lovecraft seemed to take a rich satisfaction in condemning such figures in his fiction to utter annihilation. And so that's, I don't mind the fact that in what? Reanimator, and really in effect Reanimator to the Bride, Herbert West in effect really is taken care of at the end.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
And yet, like his own work, he's resurrected.
Yeah.
Which really sort of goes along with, there are six individual pieces of this work that was submitted to a pulp magazine. And so I don't have any problem at all how Reanimator ends. And then we have Bride, because it's just like another story.
Mm-hmm.
And you could do this again. The Plague Demon is awesome because it's Arkham is ravaged by a typhoid plague. And in the midst of that plague, West and Dan are at it, and they unleash this monster who ends up killing like 14 people. Just going into houses and just ravaging people in the midst of this plague. And I thought, wow, there's a movie there too.
Oh yeah, definitely.
That would be the thing I think would be interesting. Like, you know, if you were ever going to do a remake of Reanimator, I think that would be an interesting idea. Like, you know, do faithful adaptations of the stories, you know, do them as period pieces and stuff like that, and do it the way Lovecraft wrote it. And then, but the best part is though, too, is like what from Rob was just reading a few minutes ago, about, you know, talking about the horrors that he had seen because of Herbert West and everything else. Again, you could get special practical special effects artists, and you could say to them, you know, hey, man, you know what? Take these lines that, you know, from this passage and use your imagination. Come up with some great stuff. Let's see if we could do something people had never seen before. But let's, you know, that could be a thing. Like if they ever wanted to do a remake of it, that would be, in my opinion, that would be the best way to approach it. Let's faithfully adapt Lovecraft's work. We can, you know, get Robert Eggers to do it. You know, like get him to do it. You know, he could definitely do that great old fashioned horror movie feel and everything else. Like get somebody like him to do it. But, you know, do the adaptations of the stories, you know, because like what Rob just said about they created this monster that went and killed all these people and stuff like that. And, you know, and West and Dan have to deal with it and stuff. I mean, that would be interesting. You know, you could sit there and make a series of, you know, if the first one was successful, you can make a series of movies out of that if you wanted to, you know.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you could do that, or you could just keep Stuart Gordon's using the spirit alive, yeah, and just say, look at the plague demon and say, let's use that as our home base. Ooh. And this will be an Arkham based movie during a terrible plague. And now with COVID and everything else, this stuff's still fresh in our minds.
Yeah.
And in the midst of, and you could even take an element from the horror from the shadows, you know, which, you know, at least in the, you know, in the book takes place in World War I, but the element of that is lost in the in Peru is just this over abundance of, you know, in the story you get this idea that the bodies never ended. They were just getting bodies and bodies and bodies. And you don't really get that sense in the Peruvian scene, but you would get that sense in the plague demon because of the typhoid breakout or whatever you wanted to use as your plague. You could just have that sense of where these two are trying to be the good doctors of Arkham Miskatonic Hospital. You know, they're trying to be the good doctors and help, but we've got the side work of let's use this reanimating fluid as much as we can. Maybe we can restore these people to life or whatever. And then, of course, you create this monster who's out there just almost in a Dunwich Horror type way, just out there running havoc.
Ooh, yeah.
And, you know, that is a great story. I mean, that there's a great movie there, you know, that you could you know, and that's the beauty of six different pieces to this. There's other places that you can go back into and bring to life, you know, whether you treat it as a period piece or you just kind of treat it as another, you know, sequel in maintaining the aesthetics that Gordon and Yuzna gave us.
Mm. You know, one thing... No, sorry. I was just going to say, you know, one thing, though, that I didn't even think about until you mentioned it, Rob, about how the stories always end with, you know, Wes dying, but then he just reappears in the next one. One thing that is interesting. Sorry, I'm going to give you a tiny little spoiler alert about Beyond Reanimator. I think that Yuzna planned for more sequels because at the end of Beyond Reanimator, actually, Herbert West doesn't die. He kind of, you know, because in that one, the whole movie takes place inside this Spanish prison. And, you know, Wes is in there and he's kind of like the prison doctor. And he's doing his experiments with the prisoners and stuff like this. But at the end of the movie, you know, instead of him dying, he basically just kind of like all hell is breaking loose in this prison. Wes just kind of slips out and just kind of moves on. So it was kind of different in that sense. You know, he doesn't die at the end of the third one. He just kind of, so I think, I really do. I think, you know, Yuzna did have an idea that he wanted to continue doing Reanimator movies. You know, I mean, he wouldn't have had like Wes, you know, just slip out and it's like, okay, well, you know, where's Herbert West going to turn up next? You know, so.
Wonder why it took so long to get that one out. Cause you know, you go from 85 to 90 and then suddenly it's a jump to 03, I think, right? Beyond is 03. I wonder what the why there was not such sure. A big jump, and the only one back for that one is Jeffrey Combs, right?
Well, Usna came back and directed.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, no Bruce Abbott in this one. Yeah. No, in this one he gets another. Turns out it's kind of like one of those, you know, like movies where, you know, you got the mad scientist, you know, like we've seen in like Frankenstein movies and stuff like that, where the young, you know, wannabe scientist comes up as, I know that you're Frankenstein and all this, and I don't want to report you. I want to help you. You know, I want to assist you and stuff. It's kind of the same thing in Beyond Reanimator. This young wannabe scientist finds Herbert West and just, you know, is like, hey, I want you to teach me and I want to be your pupil and, you know, I want to learn from you, yeah. That kind of a thing. So,
talk yeah, about funny lines. What about when he says, when the Arkham cop is gone, run him, just havoc in the house, and Jeffrey or Herbert West runs out the one side, and then when he comes in the front door, and she, of course, Francesca's freaking out, like, what are you doing? You've done this. And he's like, he just looks at him, he's like, yeah, she's a hysterical.
She leaves the house and really he's like, wow, better off without her.
Yeah. And that is kind of a quiet nod to the stories too, though, because the stories, Dan isn't, he doesn't have that problem.
Mm-hmm.
He is fully connected as narrator, as our narrator, but he's fully connected as his assistant to his hip. And even though he doesn't want to go to World War I, you know, Herbert West, and he follows with him, and they go up to Canada so they can go over before the United States is ever in the conflict. They go out there, and so they're out there, you know, kind of, you know, taking, you know, as much use as they can of that. I'm trying to think. So you got the Peruvian opening, you got Gloria, you've got him moving back into Dan's house. Of course, they're connected to the cemetery. You got him just doing all the weird stuff. And then, of course, maybe the great piece to the whole thing is just the so did you guys take note of what made up all the pieces of the reanimated bride?
Some of it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
It was like the foot of a ballerina.
Yeah, I wrote it all down. The
tomb of a virgin.
I wrote it all down on a nice little diagram. I made my own Herbert West diagram. So you got, you know, the feet of a ballet dancer who cut her own feet off. She committed suicide. Or maybe they take her feet from her. She committed suicide. The legs of a hooker, which is why, you know, she kind of rubs her leg up, you know, on Dan, which is kind of weird, but you understand it because it's a leg of a hooker, and that's what she would have remembered. A virgin's womb, of course, Meg's heart, the arms of a waitress. The hands were different, though. One hand belongs to a lawyer who I gotta love when he says, case dismissed. And then he runs around the table to the other, and then he's really smitten by this hand who he suggests is the hand of a murderess.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the head of Gloria and the heart of Meg. So a ballet dancer, a hooker, a virgin, arms of a waitress, a lawyer's hand, a murderess's hand, and Gloria's head. And this is your bride. And how great are the effects of that?
Oh,
amazing. I will say, though, that it's kind of weird, though, because the way they piece the body together, you can't help but sit there and think to yourself, like, okay, once you put this woman together, where do you go from there? Like, how do you expect this thing to walk around out in public? You know, like, what were you going to do? Just keep it in the house all the time? Or, you know, like, what was your plan for it after that, you know?
You know Herbert didn't think that far ahead.
Oh no, of course not. You know.
Just I want to do this. Like, what happens afterwards? I don't know.
But you're sitting there because I remember when I was watching it again the other day. It's like I was thinking to myself, it's like, you know, it's like you could, you know, it's like you two guys are experienced scientists and all this kind of stuff. You think you guys could figure out a better way to like put the body parts together to at least make it look something like an actual person, you know, and all that. You think at least Dan would have said, be like, yeah, don't you think maybe we should try to figure out a better way to piece this together? Because, you know, it's like, I mean, it's not like we're going to be able to take her out and, you know, show her around town or anything like that. You know, it's like, you know.
I think what you would have had she, had she lived the bride, I think she's the one that would have whispered in Dan's ear, we don't need West anymore.
Oh, yeah.
We don't need him anymore. It's me and you. Me and you can do this. That's And that, of course, you know, you got to love the I wish we would have got more of the flying hill head.
Yeah.
That was freaking fun. Great. That could have been really cheesy, but it works.
It does.
It works. It works. And I wish we didn't. We only got a little bit of it. And that the massacre in the hospital too was kind of, I mean, you know, what, you know, you only get the aftermath, but you know, you kind of get a sense of what they did to get out of there. And then, you know, I thought it was a little creepy that Chapham, Lieutenant Chapham, the first place he goes to on his resurrection is to the graveyard.
Yeah.
He's just gonna like be a ghoul hanging out in the graveyard. Until he's summoned by the by Dr. Hill. I wanted to revisit because of Hill more than anything. I wanted to revisit the first Reanimator, the movie. I didn't get a chance to this week or the last week or whatever. I didn't get a chance to. But how long do you basically go into that movie before he meets his demise?
Probably about 30 to 40 minutes in, something like that. He's in there a good bit of the movie before he gets killed. So almost about halfway, I would say.
And Wes takes his head, right? Takes his head off.
Yeah. Then he brings him back. Well, let's say more like 45 minutes to an hour, I would say.
Wes
takes his head off, then he reanimates him, and then
How does Meg die in there? I can't remember. How does Meg die?
She got strangled.
Yeah.
The corpse just grabs her and strangles her to death. You know, Dan was able to save her in time. So it
makes you wonder, like, how she ended up just as a heart. I mean, we've seen the cut scenes, so we know what happened. But you know,
what happened?
Well, like he reanimates her with the stuff, and then it goes well at the beginning, but then like she like kind of explodes almost.
Oh,
she like spins around and her head like goes like and everything. Yeah, it's on the blue. It's gone in like the deleted scenes.
Huh. I'll have to check it's definitely that.
Watching.
One thing I thought was funny though is like in Bride of Reanimator, like I always get a chuckle out of the line is like when because talking about, you know, Dan living in the house by the cemetery, no Fulci pun intended or anything like that, but you know, when Francesca comes over to cook him dinner and all this, and he's like, "Did you have any trouble finding the place?" And she's like, "No, it was pretty easy to find with the cemetery." That I don't know why that line always got a chuckle out of me. One thing that did surprise me, though, was I remember the very first time when I watched it, it didn't go this way, but I thought at some point, I remember the first time when I was watching, I was actually kind of nervous about Francesca because I thought at some point either something was going to happen to her or Wes was going to be like, you know what, there's something of her that we can use. So let's kill Francesca and take something from her and put it into the bride. So I remember feeling a little bit of dread for the Francesca character. Of course, it didn't turn out that way, but
yeah.
I just thought that was interesting.
Well, with Dan's luck with women, you know, she'd probably end up dead anyways.
Yeah.
It's just almost like a given.
So I wonder how much of the bride's demise is her inability to actually have this life and not being able to realizing she's not going to have Dan. She just begins to fall apart. Or is it simply tissue rejection?
I'm not sure.
I don't know. I'd say more. I mean, I love the idea of tissue rejection, but look at all the other reanimated things. None of them are suffering from tissue rejection.
Right. Yeah, now, I wonder if it's more.
I think it's something to do with ripping out the heart.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, I think there was like almost like a, what's the word I'm looking for? Like almost like an internal rejection, not a physiological one, but more like a psychological rejection of these other parts.
Yeah.
And it just kind of,
you know what would have been great?
What?
And no one, you wouldn't have caught it, but it would have been beautiful when you would have thought of it after the fact. If with one hand, with the murderess's hand, she grabs Francesca and, you know, throws her off. But when, you know, West makes his proclamation of, I made her, she turns with an accusing hand, using her lawyer's hand to point at him.
Yeah.
That would have been pretty, but that would have been something you would have thought of and talked about after the fact, you know, like, oh, yeah. How cool is that? You know, that was, and that kind of interesting how her body parts were sort of in conflict with one another. You know, at least her heart and her head and. Oh, and you did catch too, right? When she's standing there, the camera goes down and you notice that she is up on her toes like a ballet dancer.
Yeah.
That's that. Yeah, there's a lot of neat little, not neat, ugh.
Nice little touches.
I noticed Beyond is pretty cheap on DVD. I might try to snag that while it's still apt to. Can't remember who.
DVD has a certain special feature. It's a music video. And my God, I haven't seen anything as gay in my life. I'm just saying, I'm not saying, you know, that's a bad thing or whatever. I'm just saying, it is the gayest video
on the Beyond?
On Beyond Reanimator, okay. Yeah.
It's funny you point that out, Glenn, because in the book that comes in our Arrow, the write-up in there, the writer does point to what he suggests is a what seems to be an apparent or possibility of a homosexual relationship between West and Dan. I don't see it at all. I don't see it in the book, in the source material. I don't see it in the movies. I don't see it at all. I think that was forced. I think that was a forced opinion to just kind of throw out there, because I don't see it in there at all. I don't.
Well, let's be honest.
I watched it closely too. I mean, I watched, you know, anytime Wes happened to glance at him, look at him, you know, his demeanor is in. I guess I can see how somebody can pull that out, but I mean, I
think you're projecting. If you're,
you are, because even in the end of it, Dan Dan's heart is conflicted between two, well, really, between three women.
Yeah.
Meg, Gloria, and Francesca.
Dan's as straight as they come.
Yeah, and if anything, he's been duped by the bride. Because he looks at Francesca, you know, he gives her that one look for a moment. It almost implies, I think I'm kind of happy here. Now, that's short-lived, but there's a glimpse, a moment where he's like seriously considering, like, I can have Meg again. I can have Gloria. I can have my, you know, I don't know what that looks like, you know, in its, you know, but I can almost have my cake and eat it too, kind of. Yeah. Oh, thankfully that's sort of short-lived, you know, at the end, and him and Francesca are able to, you know, climb up out of there, out of the graveyard, and you know.
I don't think that there's any kind of like, I mean, if people want to read into it, that they're going to, but I think, you know, just from my interpretation of it, it seems like the reason why West is so, you know, he wants to stay with Dan is because he can manipulate him.
Well, yeah.
You know, he can all, like, West knows that he's like, look, all I got to do is just say a few words, a little double talk. I can keep getting Dan back on board with what I'm doing. You know, I can get him to get what I need him to get, or I can get him to do this for me or do that for me. And the whole thing is complete manipulation.
Yeah,
you know, he's building the bride using the heart of this one woman that Dan loved and the head of this other woman that Dan cared strongly about. He knows that if he does this, he's going to keep Dan in. That's what's keeping Dan invested.
Yeah.
And all that kind of, so I never interpret it as any kind of like gay romance or.
No, I think Herbert West, at least in the films, if anything, you could suggest any sexual pleasure that he enjoys comes from the satisfaction of seeing things come to life that he has created.
Yeah.
And that is his morbidness. That is his, you know, but there's nothing like that at all in the story. As far as I read the story, I mean, in there, he is a diabolical evil monster. I mean, he is the worst form of a mad scientist.
Let's be honest, when we talk about Lovecraft, I mean, he's very, almost like asexual to begin with.
Yeah. You know,
never really plays into any of his stories or anything, you know, and we know that him as a person, yeah, he was married for a while.
Right.
You know, and apparently he was a satisfactory lover, according to his wife, and I just don't think it wasn't a big deal.
But when things didn't go, when things weren't going the way he wanted, because I think eventually she went off to California for something, he was in New York, and he just did not like city life at all.
He
longed for home, and so he was willing to just, you know, for Lovecraft, it was her or home, and it was home.
Yep.
Even if it means not having a relationship with her, I'll be home. I want home. I want Providence. That's what made him happy. Was Providence. And yeah, and so yeah, there is probably a bit of that into the story, and as far as him and again, it's probably not a lot written into Herbert West, just because he wasn't even that apparently not that fond of the actual story itself. But still, I mean, I'm sure he, if anything, it's him being projecting himself into West. West is an interesting creature, but he's one not to be messed with.
Yeah.
Because he does not. He has one singular objective, and if it means you are between him and that singular objective, he will take you out in 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Because you have something useful. There's something useful you can give. It's one of your body parts, but there's something useful, which is great. It's just such a I've really come around a lot. I don't know what I think about Beyond when I get a chance to finally see it, but
it'll be interesting to hear, especially
I want to say, like, is it an after credit scene with the rat? That's all I'm going to say.
I think so. Yeah.
Where the rat is having a nice little fight with something. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, any last little thoughts on this?
No, I'm pretty good.
No, just no. Love Brian Ranmare, always did, always will.
Yeah, I do not to long it out or anything, but I do love it. Like, there's a few times, I think only two or three times, maybe, when you get something like when he was it when Wes says, police would never come here, and then immediately the doorbell rings.
And that happens. That's what I say. It's like a lot of those funny lines, you know. You have some good funny lines in that movie, you know. Was it hard to find? Did you have trouble finding the house? No, just I knew where it was, right by the cemetery.
There was another too, where someone, maybe it's someone, delivers the line, who would steal body parts? And then the very next frame shows Wes coming around a corner, peeking around. Yeah. Into the, it's like, God, you gotta love those little moments. That,
mm-hmm. Yeah. But, well, see, that's like another thing, though, too, is like, you know, when we've been discussing this movie, it's just, like, that's the thing. I think, you know, for a lot of people, if they've never seen it before, their first viewing, all they're not going to catch a lot of that stuff. You know, I would say, like, with the and like, from what you, both of you guys have told me, I think that that's kind of the thing. And I think that needs to be said for all three Reanimator movies, is I think they're movies that you need to watch them more than once. Definitely. All three of them. That goes for Beyond as well. Because I think there might just be something about those movies that just kind of have, like, a disconnect or something, like, a lot of people just don't pick up on it the first time. And I think, you know, just all three of those movies. So, like, that would be my advice to anybody. Like, if you've never seen any of the Reanimator movies, but you're interested in watching them, I would recommend, you know what, you know, give it at least a couple of tries. Each movie, a couple of tries, you know, because just, like, that seems to be the thing. Just a lot of people didn't pick up on it the first time. But the second time they watch it, they appreciate it a lot more. So, and that's the thing, Rob, you said you haven't even seen Beyond Reanimator yet. So, I would suggest that too. I'd say, you know what, if you watch it, you may not care for it the first time you watch it, but maybe give it a little bit of time, kind of sit on it, then maybe watch it a second time. I'm pretty sure you'll probably enjoy it a lot more. So,
and I guess I'll just say too, if you've been watching us all this time, listening and everything, and you're maybe, if you're just a fan of the movies or some of the Lovecraft inspired movies, and not really gotten that deep into his actual, and there's a lot. I mean, Lovecraft is everywhere now, but I've got the, this is just one volume I have, the Necronomicon, which has all of his main stories. But then I also have the other volume, which has his lesser known, stories, but they're same publisher, you know, but I mean, you know, you can't go wrong with just, you know, and then if you really want to go deep, deep into understanding who this guy even was, anything Joshua would have wrote, but, you know, this Lovecraft in Translation is a great, great work. And two, you know, he wrote a lot of poetry too. I've got a Joshua edited book with a collection of all his poetry. I think it's called The Ancient Track. Hippocampus Press put out a lot of the good stuff. Josh's work. Plus, if you had Vestron's release of Dagon, you got Josh on there in an interview, which is really cool.
Nice.
That's nice. A nice, and that's why I went with a Vestron and not Umbrella when it came to the Dagon release. And there's a number of Lovecraft inspired movies, man, going back to 1970 and the Dunwich Horror with, oh, I can't remember, Dean Stanton, was it?
I think so.
He was in he was the
Dean Stockwell.
Yeah, he was one of the stooges in Beverly Hills Cop 2, wasn't it? Was it part 2 he was in?
Maybe.
Yeah, I think, yeah. And then, of course, all the ones throughout the 70s, 60s even. When was Die Monster Die? That's 60s? 70s? Yes. Yeah. And then, of course, the 80s were just, I mean, you had a lot of bad ones, but some good ones. And then maybe, I think, what, the last, really the last notable one we got was Color Out of Space, adaptation by Richard Stanley, which now, thank God, he's working on the Dunwich Horror in a two-parter.
Nice.
Not wait. Oh, that thing better find its, it better be completed. And who's the stupid guy who plays Frodo?
Elijah Wood.
Elijah Wood, yeah. It's not his company, but it's the other company that also was part of Color Out of Space.
Yeah.
That company is behind him, so yeah. I don't know who's going to distribute it or however that's going to look. I'd be great if it got a theatrical and a two-parter. That would be, but if he can get the same level of work he got on Color Out of Space, I can't even imagine what Dunwich Horror is going to look like. That's going to be
definitely
why we haven't gotten more Lovecraft. It's just beyond me.
I don't know.
I think the thing is, it's like, you know, usually when you talk about Lovecraft, you know, like there's always kind of like that thing between Lovecraft and Poe. And the problem is like with Lovecraft, is like when you go to read Lovecraft, you really need to have a good analytical mind to read Lovecraft's work, because like Poe's is a little bit easier to, you know, you can kind of get Poe's work easier, but it's like, you know, like when it comes to reading Lovecraft, there's a lot of stuff going on. There's a lot of things you need to think about and all that kind of stuff. And I think just for a lot of people, it's like, it's too weird. It's too far out. It's too hard to understand. And, you know, I think, you know, when they tried to do like a lot of these adaptations, like back in the 80s and stuff like that, I think they, you know, like Stuart Gordon and like when they did Unnameable and all that kind of stuff, I think what they really tried to do is they really tried to like make it make sense and everything else by just putting it into kind of like regular like horror context. You know, I mean, if you look at like go watch the Unnameable. I mean, it's an incredibly short story, but the thing is, they almost turn it into this kind of horror slasher movie and everything, because it's easier for the audience to understand it, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's kind of the thing, is like, you really kind of like you gotta put your thinking cap on when you read Lovecraft, you know, because there's a lot going on in there that, you know, it's not just surface level stuff. Whereas like Edgar Allan Poe, you can read his stuff and it's pretty easy to get. You know, you could read Telltale Heart, and it's not a hard story to figure out. But if you try to read something like At the Mountains of Madness or something like that, you're kind of like, there's some stuff here I'm kind of confused by. You know, it's like, some stuff isn't clicking, you know. Yeah. So I think that that has something to do with it. I think, you know, just for a lot of people, I think for a lot of them, Poe is just kind of hard to adapt, you know, or it's hard to try to, like, translate to people to get them to understand it, you know.
Two quick things. One, have you seen Robert Edgar's short Telltale Heart?
No, I haven't.
It's on YouTube. That is freaking fantastic.
Okay. I'll look for that.
Freaking ten. And then the other thing I just thought of is crap. The Robert Edgar's Telltale Heart, and seemed like there was, dang it, I'm getting too old. God, I had two freaking things. It was, anyways, maybe it'll come to me. Glenn, any last fleeting thoughts, recommendations, something?
The soundtracks for both of the reanimated movies are coming out on cassette tape. So if anyone wants that, Terror Vision Recordings will put them out. So that's about it.
Oh, just real quick, I just wanted to say, like, have either of you two watched when Stephen King had that limited series, Nightmares and Dreamscapes, on television? I think it was TNT or TBS, one of those.
I remember it. I think I watched some of it.
Mm-hmm. It's like, if you ever get a chance, Rob, if you haven't seen it yet, one of the episodes on there is called Crouch End. And being the Lovecraft fan that you are and everything, if you ever get a chance, if you can find it, watch that episode, because that is Stephen King, basically his love letter to Lovecraft. And I think, honestly, I think you would appreciate that. Maybe
Oh.
not, but I think that if you ever get a chance or read the short story, that is, you know, Stephen King literally said, like, I grew up reading Lovecraft. I love his stories. I love everything he's written. And he's like, I wanted to write something that is a true homage to Lovecraft. So if you ever get a chance, yeah, if you can find the episode, watch it, or at the very least, read the short story. I think you might like it.
And yeah, and you made me think about it when you just said that. The other thing I was going to say is if you've never seen Jeffrey Combs play Edgar Allan Poe in The Black Cat, which was part of the Masters
Amazing.
of Horror, that was out of this freaking world, man.
That was
Easily
brilliant the way that was done.
the
The
best.
combination of adapting the story and Poe's biography, that was perfect. That was just a work of genius, in my opinion.
And that was Stuart Gordon, wasn't it?
Stuart Gordon,
And Jeffrey Combs was oh, what was it? Well, for anyone who doesn't know, Usna was his, the first movie that put him on the map was Society. That was a crazy, weird movie. But he also was known for Return of the Living Dead 3, the Dentist movies, and Rottweiler, and I mean, there's a few more.
Don't forget society.
Yeah.
Talk about
Society.
Usna, you can't go without society.
Of course, the score, we didn't even talk about the score, but Richard Band, how awesome was freaking the score, man? Just kind of leaping off the Psycho theme and just doing something a little different. And this did this movie being a van I mean, it's funny we were doing it for Valentine's Day, but it did premiere at the Splatterfest Film Festival in the UK in February. 1990. I don't know how close to the 16th or 14th that might have been, but yeah, I think that was it.
Oh yeah, I forgot. I was telling you guys about this one earlier. Beneath Still Waters, Brian Usna directed that one. So yeah, like I said, the CGI is absolute garbage, but you know, it's like you definitely get that fun. You could definitely tell it's a Brian Usna film. Especially when you're getting towards the third act, it definitely like it does what a Brian Usna movie does. It goes completely off the rails and just goes chaos. So that one's kind of fun. Just like I said, the CGI is absolute trash in it.
And I just remember a little trivia. Well, not it's not really trivia, but 1990. This is so funny. Cat in the Brain comes out, and it's sort of Fulci's, sort of, nod to himself and his own life's work and everything. And it's funny how this film Bride really is a farewell to what is the decade of the greatest practical effects maybe ever we've ever had. I mean, this was a decade of, I mean, just amazing things. I mean, and much in the same way, I think probably can make an argument that in 89, Intruder is says the farewell to the what was the slasher of the 80s, which was K&B's first real gig, which probably led them into Bride of the Reanimator. And everything else. I mean, well, Nicotero worked with, he was on, I think Day of the Dead was his first gig with Romero. And that's where him and I think Berger met. And of course, it's not long after that Canby is born.
One thing I thought was funny, I forget which video it was, but that ending, the maniacal cinephile on YouTube, he did a video. He's talking about, I think it was a Maniac remake. And he was talking about, like, the original effects for Maniac were done by Tom Savini. And then the remake effects were done by K&B, which tells you they're top-notch effects and everything. And K&B has gone on to do, practical effects for so many movies. So they're kind of like rolling up this list and everything else. And then one of the characters goes, "Hey, give someone else a chance, asshole." Because basically, talk about like K&B does the effects for all the movies and stuff. And they're showing this big list of movies and everything. The character's like, "Hey, give someone else a chance, asshole."
Well, I think it was Nicotero, maybe it was Berger who said, on something I heard recently. He said, you know, their ride up the ladder was so quick and fast. He said, 1 minute you're on Bride of the Reanimator, next minute you're doing crap, what was that Kevin Costner Western movie that was like 8 hours long, or not really, but
Dances with Wolves.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, they built the buffalo,
yep,
in there, and so I mean, yeah, and they of course, you know, I mean, can you say about Can being where they are today, and Nicotero and Walking Dead, and as a director and in his own right, I mean, but you know, that was a great decade.
It was,
and it's still with us. I mean, to some degree, I mean, it really is still with us. So. All right. Well, before we sign off, we should have did this at the beginning. We forgot again, but VHS 82 apostrophe is where you can find me on my YouTube channel. Lonnie, you have a brand new channel.
Yeah. My old channel used to be called Terror and Tats, but now I had to start a new movie channel. It's called Mr. McCobb's Movie Library. You can find it on YouTube. So hopefully see you all there.
And I'm sure Glenn will put the show note, or at least put the channels on there.
Definitely, yeah. You can find me at BDG Reviews on YouTube. There you go.
And as long as everything goes well, a week from now, we'll be doing our next collaboration with Body Bags. And I think we decided on physical imports in our physical media collection. Top five roundtable discussion of physical imports, the stuff that we bought outside of this country, pays to be not region locked.
That's going to be
different. I know. I got to start looking. I wanted to get this done, and then I got to start looking at my collection. And I know, you know, I've got plenty to choose from, but, you know.
Yeah.
I know it's like. No, I was just going to say spoiler, but it's like, you know, I was telling you guys a while ago, it's like, you know, I ordered the UK version of Life Force on 4K from Arrow. It's like, that's probably going to make it in my list somewhere, you know, so spoilers.
You'll have that by the time we do the show?
Huh?
You'll have that by the time we do the show?
Yeah, I'm supposed to have it by Tuesday.
Wow.
Oh, yeah, nice. Should be able to get it in and check it out. So I'm looking forward to that one.
Well, you know, yeah. No, you know, spoiler too. I mean, I'm sure. I don't know where it'll fall, but you know, my UK edition of The Thing from Another World, just because it has John Carpenter's commentary track. You know, that's going to be fun to talk about. I may have to revisit that before next Friday, because that's easily. I mean, I don't know, how does that not come over on the Blu-ray that came over here? It's beyond me.
Kind of hoping maybe one of these days, like, you know, Scream Factory or somebody will be like, hey, wait a minute, you know, let's redo, or maybe even do a 4K or something. We can include that on there, you know,
yeah,
something like that. Maybe that'd be cool, you know. That
don't make any sense to me.
I mean, they could take all that bonus stuff that was done for Creepshow and put that on there. You know, they could get the rights to Thing from Another World. Can't see why they can't. Maybe see if they could get the rights to that commentary and put that on there. That'd be nice.
Definitely.
You know, it's funny. I don't know if it'll, if it's, would make it in my list at all, but you reminded me though, Lonnie, when I first got my Creepshow from the UK, it had Just Desserts on there.
Yeah.
But when it got released over here, they couldn't put it on there. So it got released on its own release as a doc.
Yep.
And I didn't even realize that. I mean, it, you know, when I don't think I even realized that until everyone was making a big deal about Just Desserts getting a release. And I'm like, what is that? And then, you know, and I, you know, realized what it was. I went and looked at my comment. Oh, I got it already. Why is everyone crazy about it? Yeah, I'm sweaty.
You guys remember a while back when we were talking about that one, we were just, you know, having a group chat and stuff. Remember I mentioned on there that one of the bonus features on there, they had the Tom Savini volume of Scream Greats on there, volume one, and it had a commentary by Tom Savini. Remember the look on Jason's face when I said that? He was like, what? It's on there? Like, yeah, it's like, you know, it's, yeah, it's Scream Greats volume one. It's a bonus feature on there, and Tom Savini even does a commentary for it. So, oh, I think Jason was thrilled about that one. He loved that.
Unless Glenn's got something, I know we keep saying this. One last thing, though. This is independent filmmaking. You guys did see that Deadbeat at Dawn is getting a special new re-release.
Yeah, I saw that.
Can't remember who's putting that out. But that looks pretty good. I mean, that's pretty independent, low independent filming. I think I reviewed that for Body Bags when we did it that one week. But I don't own it. I had to watch it on, I don't know, some streaming source wherever I found it, or can't remember, but that was interesting. So anyways, Glenn, you wanted to just go ahead and close something?
Yeah, sure. So that is our episode. Again, like the last one, this will be on YouTube as well as on like Spotify and all those channels and all that other stuff. So yeah, check the show notes and there'll be links to our channels and everything. So yeah. Yep.
Have a good night, everybody.
Farewell and adieu to you, fair Spanish ladies. Farewell and adieu, you ladies of Spain. For we've received orders for to sail back to Boston. And so nevermore shall we see you again.